Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Myself and Coach Lou, we talk a lot about game plan. At the end of the day, he has the last say-so. And then it's for me to go relay it to the rest of the group and get those guys to buy in on what needs to be done to help us win. I don't think anyone actually knew the number or how many consecutive times they had beat us. We just knew they had beat us in game one and game two, and they beat us pretty well. We wanted to just come out with a better effort, sustain a better effort, close to 48 minutes as possible, and live with the results. Well, in the last 2 years, we've had some extreme situations happen to us, and so guys have been able to just, you know, next man up. That's always been our motto. You know, for someone that's out and can't perform or can't play at that point in time, then it's next man up. And
all about our efforts, especially the starting five, how we start the game, because you assume they're going to play with the same energy as they did in game three. For us, we have to just stop that force that they play with in game three and come with more effort and more focus from the jump.
Representing all of hockey with great distinction for five decades, number nine.
Howe coming up on the right side. Howe over the line to his father. Son to father. Back in turn.
Tell you what, Danny, so do I. It's just a pleasure to see this big guy out there. Big Father Time still doing his thing out here, and they're going to give him a standing ovation here in the Montreal Forum.
He was the one guy without a weakness. He had wonderful shots, front hand, backhand. He was ambidextrous, so he could shoot from both sides. He was big. He was tough. He was a wonderful skater. He had maximum anticipation. Gordy, in his whole career, never wasted a step. He could figure out where the puck was going, and he'd go there in the shortest distance.
He could kill penalty, pay the power play, regular shift. He used to carry the puck smooth. You know, very dangerous. He could shoot the puck. Strong player.
He could do everything on the ice, and he was so big and strong that they feared him when he was out there. And he could put the puck in the net. He could make the plays. He was the all-round ultimate hockey player.
Welcome to the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
This afternoon, a Friday afternoon extravaganza on 106.5 The Ticket. And you know what Friday afternoon means? It means Free for All Friday. And that means anything that you want to talk about today is pretty much up to you. We'll take your phone calls on anything and everything from Game 4 of the NBA Finals to the sad passing of Mr. Hockey, Gordie Howe, to the ongoing funeral service and a memorial service, if you will, honoring and commemorating the life of Muhammad Ali. To baseball, the draft was held yesterday. Not obviously as big a news when you have the baseball draft as when you have the NFL draft, certainly, which is king. But even the NBA draft, because so many of the players are from high schools and are unknown. But still, nonetheless, something that we would love to talk to you about today. So if you've got thoughts on any of those things, we will indeed take your phone calls. And we invite you to make them starting now at 866-240-1065. 866-240-1065. Don't forget, you may also, if you so choose, you may also text our program. Just type the word Toledo and send a message to us to 68255. The word Toledo has to come first in your message for it to reach me. We'll take a look at those. Then also, you can tweet or Facebook comment to the program today at Sports Radio 106.5 on Twitter and at 106.5 The Ticket on Facebook. So we got 2 hours of discussion this afternoon on a Friday, again, that we will let you drive. We are also, indeed, look, you know, I'm going to say what I said earlier this week after last weekend's passing of Muhammad Ali, the greatest fighter of all time, the greatest boxer of all time, with the greatest showman of all time. At one point or another, he's been called all of those things by somebody. Now, there might not always be full agreement that he was the greatest boxer of all time. Some may give that title to Joe Louis. Some may give that title to some of the some of the lighter weight guys who are legends of the ring. But when you take a look at Muhammad Ali's career, as I said earlier this week, and I don't want to repeat the whole thing, but if you take a look at his career and you look at the caliber of opponents that he fought when the heavyweight division was still the marquee division in all of sport, maybe in all of sport, not just boxing, but literally the heavyweight division at the time, better than any NFL division of teams, a baseball division of teams, or any, quite frankly, anything. Great golfers competing with one another at one time. There was a time in the 60s and early 70s when those fighters we're talking about were every bit as good as one another, and they took turns pounding on one another, and the greatest of all of them was Muhammad Ali, which is why he is so widely regarded as the greatest of all time. Whether it's true or not is a matter of opinion, but that's what so many hold. And he's always been the greatest showman of all time. Always. So they're laying him to rest today. They're remembering his life. All the positive things, obviously, in this memorial service today. And I'm going to be very, very pleased to be able to cut in and listen to some of the memories. Brian Gumbel is going to be among those eulogizing. Muhammad Ali, former President Bill Clinton, is going to be eulogizing him. I'm not sure what their tie or their connection is, but he is going to be there as well, and a couple of other folks. So we're going to try to tune in and check in and monitor that through ESPN Radio, our partners, of course, as we are ESPN 106.5, the ticket. So I want to talk Muhammad Ali, and again, we'll do so. We're going to talk about the passing of Gordie Howe, which, of course, is tragic. Obviously a long, long life for Mr. Hockey. And it's just wonderful from time to time to be able to do what we're going to do today, and that is just look back at the career of one of the greatest players, arguably the greatest hockey player. And I know when we talk, how about that? The word great being thrown around everywhere today, and with good reason. I was about to say, Gordie Howe, sometimes still referred to by those who watched him play and knew the game best, still sometimes referred to as the greatest hockey player ever, even though, as I was about to say, the great one, which, of course, is Wayne Gretzky, is usually given that honor. But it's just a great opportunity to, again, look back at the career of Mr. Gordie Howe and pay respects to it. Those younger people who don't know a whole lot about hockey or a whole lot about his career, Gordie Howe's career, certainly get an education from folks who watched him play, as they look back at his life as well. And this, of course, just getting started as his passing was earlier this morning. So a lot of that stuff to talk about today, commemorations of greatness in hockey and in boxing and beyond. But I want to start with the current topic you heard at the top of the show. The montage was primarily about game number 4 of the NBA Finals. To say that this is a must-win game for the Cavaliers is an understatement. It's at home again. They're down 2-1, so they have to win to even it at two. I think almost everybody agrees that if they lose game 4 tonight and are down 3-1, the series ends on, when would they play, Sunday? Or is it Monday? I actually don't have the schedule in front of me. I don't know if there's a one-day break or a two-day break between games 4 and 5.
I believe it's Monday.
You think it's Monday, Chris?
Yeah,
Chris
says it's Monday.
Yeah, they usually have 2 games in between when they got to travel that far. So 2 days in between, not 2 games. So anyway, I think most observers would agree that if the Cavs don't win and they fall down 3-1, that the series ends on Monday in Oakland in game number 5 on the Warriors' home floor. They're going to be smelling it. They're going to be 48 minutes away from a back-to-back championship, and there's no way they're going to lose on their floor. However, what people aren't saying going into game number 4 tonight that I quite frankly think needs to be said is that this is a must-win game for the Golden State Warriors. Don't think for 1 second that they're just going to be content and happy and comfortable losing game number 2 like this, or I'm sorry, second straight game, 2 in a row, evening the series at 2 games apiece, and just saying, that's okay, we'll win on our floor in game 5, and then they'll come back here and we'll see if we can close them out in their place and make their locker room, visitors' locker room, smell like champagne again like last time. But even if we don't, that's okay, we'll get them at our place in game 7. Don't think that at all. I'm going to tell you this. Steve Kerr said at the post game at the post game press conference, Steve Kerr said, we walked out there and got punched in the mouth. They punched us in the mouth early, right in the first quarter, and they never relented, and they never let up. And that's true. And like so many other teams that are used to bullying other teams, not that the Warriors are bullies in that way, you know, in the bad boys way. Bullies just in running teams on the, off the floor just by shooting threes at will and playing the game like Loyola Marymount used to play college basketball in the 80s. You're going to have to be old enough to remember that reference, too. If you don't remember Loyola Marymount, look up some of their game scores. Look up how they played the game. You'll be mesmerized. Anyway, when a team has been pounding other teams like that, you kind of look at them as a bully. And when the bully gets punched in the mouth, the first thing they usually do is what? Come at you harder? No. Generally speaking, when bullies get punched in the mouth for the first time, they crumble. They don't know what to do. They don't know how to handle it. Nobody's ever stood up to them before. Nobody's punched them in the mouth before. So they got punched in the mouth in game three, according to Kerr. If the Cavaliers go out and do the same thing, and if they run them tonight, and I'm not saying win by 30 again, but if they just run them, and if they even the series of two with a win that's moderately decisive, you know, even low double digits. Now, I'm not saying that if the Cavs win on a buzzer beater that everything is different, but it's certainly much more conceivable that if the Cavaliers win a close game tonight like that, the Warriors aren't really deterred in their quest. They still think they're better, and they do go back in Game 5, and they beat the Cavaliers, and the whole scenario plays out. Can the Cavs hold serve on Game 6 and bring it to 7 or not? But if the Cavs go out there and do more than just eke one out, if the Cavaliers tonight in Game 4 at Quicken Loans Arena out in Cleveland, if they do indeed blow the Warriors out again, if they do indeed win comfortably, even if it's not a blowout, I think old Mo, and I don't mean to sound like, you know, 1972's standard, typical, stereotypical football coach, but good old Mo is on our side. Momentum. But it is. It means more than people realize. I'm just going to say it that way. It really does. It can build upon itself, and if you allow it to, it can carry you to places that you probably don't deserve to be. Momentum can take you that far. And that's what the Cavaliers have a chance to build for themselves tonight. Momentum to go into their building, talking about the Warriors building, and win in Game 5. Win in Game 5 so that you don't have to win in Game 7, and that you can come home and take care of business and finish it out, smelling it in front of your own home crowd. Smelling it in Game 6, 48 minutes away from the first title in that city since 1964. The first professional title for anybody in the state of Ohio since 1990. We talked about that a little bit earlier this week, didn't we? Last time a professional team in the state of Ohio, and if you think of them all, Cleveland Indians, Browns, and Cavaliers, Cincinnati Reds, and Bengals, Columbus Blue Jackets. That's it, right? Am I missing anybody?
Not off the top of my head. Nope.
I mean, when I say professional, too, I mean at the highest level. No disrespect to the Mud Hens, Columbus Clippers, or anything. But,
sure.
But, you know, at the big level, at the varsity level, nobody has won anything since the Reds won the World Championship, the World Series. They swept the heavily favored Oakland A's in 1990.
Yeah, the Big Red Machine.
No, that wasn't a Big Red Machine.
Oh,
bite your tongue, youngster. Big Red Machine was in the 1970s.
The 1974, 75,
76, 77. Big Red Machine was Pete Rose. Big Red Machine was Johnny Bench. It was Joe Morgan. It was George Foster. It was Cesar Geronimo. It was Davey Concepcion. It was Ken Griffey Sr. That was the Big Red Machine. It was a different time. Tony Perez. This is the Eric Davis, Chris Sabo, beg your pardon. I know somebody named Chris Sabo. He'd love that I just compared him to Chris Sabo. Sabo. That was the Nasty Boys, Rob Dibble, and Randy Myers and Norm Charlton. Yeah, two guys who could come in from the left side at 98, 99, and one on the right who could do the same out of the pen. The Nasty Boys, they swept the A's. And I believe those were the, like, McGuire, Canseco, Ricky Henderson, I mean, that was a monster team for the Oakland A's. Anyway, that we're just kind of strolling down memory lane right now. But nobody in the state of Ohio has won a world championship at the pro level since 1990. That's 26 years ago. That's pretty doggone amazing. So if the Cavaliers get an opportunity to do that in Game 6 at their place, don't even expect them to let it slip away and have to go back to Golden State to win it in Oakland in a Game 7. So setting you up for Game number 4 tonight, the big storyline of Game number 4, two storylines actually going into it that we want to talk about a little bit. And again, we invite you at 866-240-1065 to join us if you are indeed ready to do so and when you are ready to do so. The two big storylines are Steph Curry and Kevin Love. Steph Curry, because everybody, including almost every media member in the Bay Area, wants to know why the NBA's two-time MVP, back-to-back, the NBA's defending world champion, the NBA's unanimous MVP this season, first time in history, the NBA's leading scorer with 31 points a game. Why he all of a sudden sucks in the NBA Finals? How Steph Curry, in a showdown with LeBron James, in a showdown that not only is supposed to help cement him as one of the game's all-time greats by winning back-to-back titles, I think everybody would agree, you go back-to-back, and that means everybody from, you know, the Rockets to the Pistons to the, you know, three-peat teams like the Lakers to the Celtics and so on. You go back-to-back, you're considered an all-time great team, and the stars, they go down in history as all-time great stars. Steph Curry, in an opportunity to grab that, also has an opportunity to finish what many people believe has been started, and that is the transition of or from the league's face from LeBron James to Steph Curry. Curry is a two-time MVP. LeBron has won 4. But Curry is 1-0 in NBA Finals and is the defending champion. LeBron is 2-4. Curry won a world best, history's best, 73 games in the NBA this season. The Cavs had the best record in the Eastern Conference. Would have been about fourth or fifth best in the West. Curry had an opportunity to finish what people started when they said Curry is now the best player in the NBA. Curry is the new face of the NBA. He has taken down LeBron from that throne, if you will, that King James sits upon. Well, here he is in the finals with a chance to prove it head-to-head, mano-a-mano. And the bottom line is, he's awful. 31 points a game in the regular season, knocked down to 16 points a game through 3 games of the NBA Finals. Now, I was an English major and not a math major, but let me see if I can do that math in my head. 31 points a game, down to 16 points a game. That's about half. I didn't even need my calculator for that. That's about half. Not to mention, assist total down, rebounds down, turnovers way up, shooting percentage way down. All of that going on with Steph Curry. Why? Is he feeling the pressure of trying to unseat LeBron James as the NBA's face and best player? He doesn't have a 20-point game in the finals yet. You go back, and I don't know what it is. I'd like to say that it's the pressure he feels from his counterpart at the point guard position, Kyrie Irving. But I can't, because Kyrie, of course, only played in Game 1 of last year's Finals. But if you do go back to last year's Finals, Steph Curry was solid, I guess, right? Solid? Not spectacular. There's a reason they gave the MVP of last year's Finals, 1-6 games by the Warriors, to Andre Iguodala. And that's right, NBA announcers, it's Iguodala. There's a U there. It's not Iggadala. It's not Iguodala. And I don't want to hear the, well, Andre said it can go either way, and he's fine with either one. Yeah, I know. I also know that his father says the name is Iguodala, but people mispronounced it for so long, they just went ahead and took it. Don't give in to mispronunciations. It's Andre Iguodala. G-U, gua. Got it? The English teacher in me comes out whenever I hear people misspeaking. I'm sorry. Anywho, there's a reason they gave it to Andre Iguodala, even though he was kind of lit up by LeBron in terms of scoring percentage or scoring point totals and everything else. But it wasn't Steph. He won the MVP in the finals last year. He has been a huge, huge deficiency for them this year through 3 games, even though they have a 2-1 lead. Question is, what's wrong with him? And oh, by the way, the fact that Steph Curry is playing so poorly in these finals and still up 2-1, you would think means that his fellow All-NBA splash brother, Klay Thompson, was lighting it up. But guess what? He's not either. Klay didn't score until the 6:34 mark of the second period of the first half in Game 3. Wound up scoring 10 on 4-for-13, and of course getting that thigh bruise from the pick set by Timofey Mozgov. Curry is averaging 16 points on 43% shooting. He's 10 of 25 from three-point range. Think about that, considering where he shot nearly 50% in the regular season. He has 13 assists and 15 turnovers, and because they're hounding him so much outside the arc, he's not even getting to the basket. He's only attempted 4 free throws in 3 games. Think about that. Thompson's averaging 12 on 36% shooting. The point to all of that is it's not an accident when it happens for 3 straight games. How did Kush refer to it yesterday? Once can be an accident. Twice could be a coincidence. The third time is a problem. You got a problem. It's a habit. It's an issue. It's the way that it is. And I think the way the Cavaliers defend them is spectacular. Now, I won't go too far off into the woods on this because I also remember when they were held down big time by Russell Westbrook and by Kevin Durant and by the rest of the Oklahoma City Thunder that had them down 3-1 and they rolled them games 3 and 4. And while they also had big momentum going on their side, going back to Oakland and to take on the Warriors in game number 5, they didn't seize the opportunity. In fact, Golden State won game 5 relatively handily before coming back to Oklahoma City and shocking them in game number 6. And then by that time, you're going back to game 7 in Oakland. Forget about it. There's no way Oklahoma City was winning. That could be a possibility here. I'm not going out into the woods and saying Cavaliers win tonight, they win the series. But I'm just saying that if they win tonight handily, they have every opportunity to go to Oakland and win game number 5 in Oakland on Monday and then to close this thing out at home with 4 straight. They have every opportunity to do that. So tonight is a must-win for the Cavs, but it's also a must-win for the Warriors. And then finally, getting back to point number 2, I said there's 2 storylines to this game for me, and that'll go to your calls. I see you there. Hang on. The other storyline is Kevin Love. According to virtually all the reports that we're seeing right now, Kevin Love is probably not going to start tonight for the Cavaliers if indeed he's ready to rock and he is cleared. The bottom line is Kevin Love, according to most reports, is going to come off of the bench, try to provide some offense, try to provide some pop, whatever you want to call it, and that is going to be the way Ty Lue plays it, that Richard Jefferson is going to start the basketball game the way they did in game number 3. And let me say this about that. I'm fine. I get it. I understand the defense that Richard Jefferson provided. I understand the different kind of threat offensively that he provided. Gave them a lift, and it is different. It makes the Warriors defend them differently and attack them differently, quite frankly, than when Love is on the floor. But let me also say this about that. If Kevin Love is coming off the bench, and he's doing so in his building. The Q is his house, just like it's LeBron James' house. The Q is his house, just like it's Kyrie Irving's house. He might not be on the star level of those two guys. When you talk about the big three, it's not like they are interchangeable. But he is also not a scrub. And when he does this in his house, comes off the bench in his house, I better hear through my TV set loud ovations and cheers and support for Kevin Love. If I hear one boo coming from that building tonight, I will be extraordinarily disgusted with Cavaliers fans all around the country. Whether they're concentrated there in Northeast Ohio, whether they're living in Northwest Ohio, I don't care where they are, I will be disgusted. Because far too many fans have taken to hating on Kevin Love, blaming him for all of their woes. Love is soft. Love is too inconsistent. He's not a good shooter. Love isn't dedicated to rebounding anymore. Love isn't the all-star that we thought we were getting when we traded away the first-round pick of the draft, Wiggins, for him. Fans are really, really quick to jump on this cat, and I don't like it. If he comes off that bench to anything other than an ovation, and you pump him up and support him, then you are hurting the cause. Not about his feelings. You're hurting the cause for the Cavaliers to try to win a championship. Make no mistake about that. People who love to hate him, love to hate on him, don't really understand the way the game is played and the way that the Cavaliers are making him play it. When people look and say, hey, he was 26 and 14 on a nightly basis in Minnesota. Here he's 17 and 8 or 9, sometimes 10. Don't understand. What they've done is they've taken his 6'11 frame and turned it into a 6'4 shooting guard. He's a spot-up three-point shooter. He stands out there like he's J.J. Redick. He stands out there like he's just a J.R. Smith on his own team. That's all he's able to do. And it's not by his choice, I absolutely believe. It's by design of David Blatt, first Ty Lue now, to create space inside. They don't want him on the block where he did great things in Minnesota. They want him outside, stretching the defense, hence the name Stretch 4, so that LeBron can penetrate, so that Kyrie can penetrate, so they can finish and do their thing without all of that extra traffic down low. That's the way they have chosen to use Kevin Love. That, my friend, is not Kevin Love's fault. So don't be scapegoating him and saying, we won without him, we lost with him, therefore we don't want him. Don't do it. It's wrong. It's a mistake. And it will indeed be detrimental to the cause, which is trying to win the championship. Don't take out your frustrations on Kevin Love when he comes into the game, if that's the way it goes down tonight. Root for him. Cheer for him. Pump him up. Get him hitting shots. Get him grabbing boards and making slick outlet passes. And move on without the hatred. Enough of the haterade for Kevin Love. All right. So there you go. Just a little bit to kind of lay it out for you. A few things that I had to get out that I wanted to say. I would love to hear from you, too. Let me get one in before we take a bottom of the hour break, if I can. We got a Sports Center coming up, but Phil has been waiting in Toledo. Let's do that right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. How you doing there, Phil?
I'm doing well. Thanks for my call. I'll make it brief.
Sure thing.
I want to start by saying I'm rooting for the Warriors all the way in this series, but the thing I've been most impressed with through the whole thing has been the play of Richard Jefferson. He's created a spark, I think, that has kept a lot of the Cavaliers players in the game. And the plays he's come up with have just been huge hustle plays, huge momentum plays. And I think that kind of invigorates some of the other Cavs players to do well. And when he hit that three early in game three to put him up by, I think it was like 8 or something like that, I said, all right, here we go. It's going to be a tough night for the Warriors. So I just wanted to speak to the consistency and the impressiveness of what Richard Jefferson has been in this series.
All right, Phil. I appreciate the call, man. Thank you. I'll tell you this about that, or I'll say this about that. I agree. The only problem with that scenario is then expecting it again tonight. It shouldn't be lost on anybody that he's 38, you know? He doesn't have the legs, the young, spry legs, to run and do his thing at any moment's notice and consistently on a regular basis. That's why he's a bench player now in the league. He is indeed an older player. But yes, in spots, given the right number of minutes where he's able to go full out and expend every bit of energy, I think you just call them hustle plays. And that's the kind of thing that the Cavaliers didn't get much of in games 1 and 2, hustle plays in order to track down what we like to call 50-50 balls. He grabs those. He gets those. He lays out for those. You're 100% right, but he can't do that on a nightly basis. It's just too difficult because he's a little bit older, like I said. The other thing is, for his age, again, given his age, Richard Jefferson can still play the game above the rim. Richard Jefferson can play the game in rare air, even at his age. Again, not every time down and not multiple times a week, that kind of a thing. But, you know, in a finals where you're playing every couple of days and his minutes are limited, use him. Let him get out there. I mean, he's throwing down. He's stroking threes. He's hitting transition shots. He's rebounding. He's doing a little bit of absolutely. And that's why I say I'm fine to start him. All I'm following up with that with is this. Start Richard Jefferson. Enjoy him, respect him, and get every little bit that you can out of him. But don't hate on Kevin Love as a result. Don't think Jefferson's better than Love. Let's keep it that way. He's better than Love in spots and at certain things, particularly on the defensive end on the perimeter. But Kevin Love has a very, very big role to play, and I don't want anybody taking him out of his game. But, yeah, I love Richard Jefferson. I loved when they made the signing. I thought it was a great upgrade over the, you know, other previous veteran shooter kind of guys that they bring in to stabilize the James Joneses of the world, the Sean Marion, those kind of guys. I loved when they brought Richard Jefferson in, and he's showing us exactly why right now. All right, let me get a timeout here, bottom of the hour, Sports Center. If you want to get on the hold, let's do so. 866-240-1065. Talk about the NBA Finals Game 4. We're going to check in with Jim Cushlin, who's out at YARC tonight as well. Then we want to also check into the Muhammad Ali Memorial Service as the greatest is laid to rest with a tremendous celebration of his incredible life. His incredible accomplishments. We're going to check in with ESPN Radio on the services as well for Muhammad Ali. And then also, speaking of memorial services, those are going to be in the works very, very soon for Mr. Hockey, Gordie Howe, who passed away earlier today. This morning is when that happened. And the legendary Red Wing, one of the greatest, if not the greatest of all time, certainly would deserves our attention and our respect, too. So all of that's still coming up as we continue on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Now back to the Bob France Extravaganza, ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
3:44 as we continue on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket on a free-for-all Friday afternoon right here, ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. You got thoughts you want to share with us? Get on the line now at 866-240-1065. But as you do that, we want to get back out to YARC, Chrysler, Jeep, Dodge, and Ram. Jim Cushlin hanging out, selling cars today, having a great day. Getting ready for game number 4 of the NBA Finals. Going to talk a little bit more again about Muhammad Ali being laid to rest today. Memorial service celebrating his life going on. And, of course, the passing of Mr. Hockey, Gordie Howe. You just heard all that stuff. Cush checking in with us once again from YARC. What's up, man?
Just hanging out and enjoying the weather. I'm inside for right now to talk to you, but then heading back outside to attempt to horribly sell cars, I'm sure.
Kick the tires on a couple of cars and trying to see what you're taking home, right?
That's rumbled through my head, no doubt about it.
It always does. Whenever I go out to a YARC dealership, I love that. And, of course, my wife hates it because I come home with some brochures and some prices. What do you think? She's like, stop it. We don't need a new car yet.
Well, at least you're not like Peter Griffin that didn't come home with a blimp or something.
No, that's not going to happen anytime soon. All right, Cush, how about J.R. Smith pouring a little gasoline on the fire? Hey, J.R., who should have been the MVP? Steph Curry? Nope. He said he would have picked LeBron James first and Russell Westbrook next instead of Steph Curry, who ended up winning the award unanimously from USA Today, quote, other than LeBron, I really don't know who else I'd vote for. I mean, somebody who does everything for a team, whether it's scoring, getting stops, rebounds, steals, block shots. There's no more of a complete player, so I don't see how he couldn't be the most valuable. And then when they said, if you can't vote for a Cavalier, who would you vote for? Well, it's got to be Steph Curry, right? If I couldn't vote for somebody on my own team, I'd probably vote for a guy like Russ. I mean, he's got the energy, the effort, consistently got the total package. You got to go for a guy like that. And what about Steph Curry? He was asked. Top five. Definitely in my top five. You take him out of the equation, they're a different team. He would definitely be in there, absolutely. So how about J.R. Smith going into game five, or four, beg your pardon, tonight out in Cleveland against a Steph Curry who has been just a non-factor, 16 points a game in the three games in the finals thus far, which is just about half of the 31 he scored per game in the regular season. Steph Curry getting disrespected by J.R. Smith, saying he'd be top five, but his unanimous MVP, forget about it.
Well, my first thought is I'll back it up. Make sure you back it up and don't disappear, J.R., like you did in games one and two. But the other factor of that is this feels like the kind of thing that goes back to that old conversation. Every time there's something with an MVP award, in any sport, Bob, not just the NBA, and it's is it most valuable or are you treating it as a best player? You know, that kind of dynamic, and if it's the true definition of valuable, you know, I still think that goes to LeBron. We all saw what happened, 6 years ago when LeBron left that team, and if he were to suddenly not be there right now, what would probably happen to this team? But Curry is right now, based on what he's been able to do, he's still the best player right now in the league. And yes, he's had a bad finals, and that may obviously continue, but that's about the Cavs' defensive things that they've been doing in these first three games. But in terms of, is that going to be bulletin board material? I'm not so sure. Golden State doesn't make me feel like one of those teams that's going to get fired up over the proverbial.
No, maybe not Golden State, just Steph. Just Steph.
Maybe.
That's all I'm talking about is just Steph, because he didn't say anything about Golden State. He said it about Curry, that he's not my MVP, LeBron would be, then Russell. And I'm just saying that while Curry has been down in this series, obviously, and kind of looking almost disinterested for various points in, you know, periods of time.
That,
you
know, sure showed, like, itself in Game 3 when Kerr more or less benched him at one point. You saw the look on his face. It was a whatever is the kind of vibe I got from that look.
He just seems kind of out of it, and I guess I don't necessarily want somebody snapping him back to reality and saying, you know, what did he just say? Because sometimes you diss somebody in such a way, even if it's not meant as a diss, but if you diss somebody in such a way who is that great, it kind of snaps them out of their funk and says, really, dude, that's what you think of me? And it gets them right back into their groove. And that's what I don't want to see happen.
No, and I don't want to obviously see that happen either, and that'll be interesting to see if he's the kind of guy that takes any of that kind of motivation, because first of all, Curry will be the first one to tell you he certainly did in the post game the other night that, hey, I didn't do anything to help my team win. You know, this is on me as much as anybody else right now. And, you know, the last kind of thing you want is, I'm remembering a random 30 for 30, Bob, that I watched recently. It was on the Shaq Magic and how they got those two number ones and all that stuff. And they got to the part where they were in the 96 East Finals, where the Bulls, this is the 72-win Bulls, by the way, that then swept the Magic in that series. And from all those players' perspectives, and even Jordan himself popped on the screen, they were more or less saying, yeah, you know, I was kind of motivated by when the year before you guys were kind of saying, oh, 45's not like 23. So we'll see if Curry has that same kind of mentality that a Jordan certainly did. And we'll see. He doesn't need any extra motivation, I don't think. And you certainly don't want to, you know, poke the bear, as it were.
Yeah, and that's kind of what I feel like he may have done. That's my whole reason for bringing it up. Did JR poke the sleeping bear right now and wake him out of his slumber and make him dedicated to go out there tonight? And, you know, well, and look, let's be honest. He and Clay both were shut down pretty much for most of Game 3 and Game 4 of the Western Conference Final against the Thunder. And then, you know, and then he's decided, all right, I'm turning it on now. I don't know if anybody said anything to disrespect him then, at least from Oklahoma City. A lot of people just said he's getting his lunch eaten by Russell Westbrook, his counterpart, you know, at the point guard position. But he turned it on, and certainly he's capable of doing that at any time, it appears, unless the Cavaliers just have his number. And, Jim, before you came on in the last segment, too, I brought this up, you know, that he didn't win the MVP in the finals last year either. He had a solid series, but he was not spectacular. Maybe some guys just are, I don't know, unable to get it done in the same way they do against everybody else, against some teams. Sometimes somebody gets your number.
Yeah, and we've obviously seen that through these three games, and you mentioned last year when it was Iguodala, and Curry had an okay series. He didn't have one of those Steph Curry blowing up like the 17 points in overtime a few weeks back in the semis against Portland. So he didn't have that great of finals, but it was decent. And this year he's not obviously having a good one, and even though it's 2-1 right now, after three games, if I had a vote, it's clearly still Draymond Green, as long as the Warriors lead, and Curry's not even being brought up right now.
Draymond Green is your MVP so far in this series?
In this series, as it stands as of right now.
So you're gonna let the tremendous game two that he did have, no doubt about it, you're gonna let that erase the horrendous game three that he had, because he was
at this moment while the Warriors are still leading the series. Yes. If it gets tied tonight, I'm going to start changing my mind and throw some other names in there, probably at least one Cav as I'm thinking about it. But with Golden State still leading as of right now, it's Green to me as of this moment. But that can change.
Yeah, I'd have to do some serious thinking about that right now. Who's the MVP for the Warriors through three games? And who's the MVP for the Cavaliers through three games, to be honest with you? You know, you could say LeBron James, because he had a dominant game, really, in this last one, 14 of 26, 32 points, and what was it, 11 rebounds or so, and 5 assists or 6 assists. But to me, he was so pedestrian in games 1 and 2, I don't know if that works. Kyrie probably had, I think he had his equivalent of a game in this last one in the win to LeBron James, and probably played a little bit better than he did in game 1. Nobody played well in games. That's tough. That's really tough. But I'd have to go back and look at the Warrior stats to see who I think that would be there.
The only other guy I might think of for the Warriors would be Harrison Barnes, possibly, because since the Cavs have been focusing, understandably, so much defensive attention on Curry and Thompson, Harrison Barnes has quietly had himself a very good finals through three games. And, you know, what's interesting, you brought up LeBron and his quote-unquote pedestrian numbers. Even in the game two, or in one of the two games on the road they lost, I think it was the second one, they weren't great, but they still were nearly a triple-double, which just goes back to how, you know, where the expectation level is when you're talking specifically about LeBron James. Anybody else putting up the numbers that he did in these three games would be hailed for it, but since it's a 2-1 deficit for the Cavs, and until game three he didn't really go off, you're kind of, oh, it's pedestrian. I always find those kind of things fascinating when you're at a different player level, like when you're talking about someone like LeBron.
I mean, we see that all the time. Once you set a bar for yourself that's a certain height, and you don't go to that height, you suddenly, you're not playing
exactly
so well. Even though that's better than everybody else, but I'd have to think about that. All right, so let's get to the Cavaliers side real quick. And again, if you want to get in on this conversation today or anything else, it is Free For All Friday, 866-240-1065. What do you expect tonight? Will the Cavaliers win in Game 4, forcing this back to Golden State with momentum for the Cavs and a 2-2 series, or does Golden State win and essentially win the series? Because I believe, Jim, that if Golden State wins tonight, they win this thing in 5. They go back home with momentum because they staved off the little mini explosion the Cavs had in Game 3. They came back to win, and they will close it out at their place. That's my belief. But I also believe that if the Cavaliers win tonight in reasonably easy fashion, and when I say that, I mean, you know, a very low double-digit type win, not a nail-biter, but not a blowout, but solid fashion, I think they can go in and win Game 5. I really do at Golden State. But if they lose tonight, I don't think they have a chance in Game 5.
I'm certainly with you on the if they lose, go down 3-1, series heads back to Oakland with 2 days off because it'll be in the travel situation again.
Yeah.
Yes, I'm completely with you on that. If it's 3-1 around midnight-ish tonight, then we're probably looking at a Monday being the finale of this series. If the Cavs win, that's an interesting one, because I'm glad you specified that and said, you know, it comfortably and things like that, because I think there's two possible outcomes depending on the game, whether it's a real close one or if it's similar to Game 3. If it's similar to Game 3, then Game 5 is the chance. The momentum, as you mentioned, would be back with the Cavs, even though the buildings would have switched again, and it'd be all even up at 2. You get a different feel, even if it's 2-2, if this is a two-possession game that's decided by what Curry and LeBron do in the final minutes.
Yeah, I think that's that is a very big determining factor, the way that ends, and like I said, what kind of victory it would be for the Cavs. So to the Kevin Love question, before we get a timeout here for Top of the Hour Sports Center and come back and talk a little Muhammad Ali, the Kevin Love situation, he has not been cleared to play. Right now, the last word I got was that he will be literally a game-time decision.
Yep,
now, whether
that's what I heard too.
Whether that's for actual, we don't know how healthy he is and whether he's going to be cleared purposes or not, or whether that's for let's let Golden State wonder what they're going to see, I don't know. But I just know that he's going to be a game-time decision. If that game-time decision is yes, he can go, he's able to play, what do you think Ty Lue does? You had LeBron James, by the way, commenting on that. He was asked what he thinks should happen, and he said the ball is in Ty Lue's court. As to whether or not Kevin starts or Jefferson starts, the coach makes out the lineup. What do you think he'll do?
Well, what I think he would do if Kevin Love is cleared is I think he would start, and then an adjustment would be made at the first sign of trouble, specifically on a defensive end. What I would love to see happen, though, is you continue to start Richard Jefferson, put LeBron at the four. That seemed to make a ton of difference defensively against Draymond Green in Game 3. You bring Love off the bench, a bench, by the way, that, let's face it, Bob, has been awful in this series in three games for the Cavs. a guy like Kevin Love, in theory, is exactly the kind of boost your bench would need from an offensive standpoint. And quite frankly, if it goes down that way, we always hear about, you know, players, especially bigger time players, complaining if they get, you know, taken out of lineups and things like that. It happens all the time, as we know. This is the finals. Sometimes you got to do this. Kerr did it last year to a guy who was once upon a time the number one overall pick in Bogut. And I think this is a moment where Love will have to swallow some of his pride, come off the bench, and quite frankly, if the Cavs pull off this series, do you really think he's going to complain about being on the bench, especially if he contributes off the bench? Do you think he's really going to complain next month when he's polishing a ring? I don't think so.
I don't even think he'll complain tonight if he comes off the bench. I think he gets it. He understands. I mean, look, you had a hot hand in Richard Jefferson who's playing well on both ends of the floor and helping. You're coming off a win. If Ty Lue says to him, Kev, this isn't personal and this isn't a commentary on how you played before you got hurt and got into this concussion protocol, but we're on a little bit of a roll right now. I'm going to start RJ, keep LeBron at the four. It really messed them up last time, and we're going to roll with it and see what happens. You will come off. You're still going to get your minutes, and we expect production. I think Kevin Love would look at him and say, let's go, coach. He's not that guy where he needs to be, you know, I'm the starter, I'm the star, or the third star, or the whatever.
Right.
I truly think he would be fine with it, and that's what I'll be honest with you, I predict is going to happen. I think
I've seen no evidence to suggest that he would be the kind of guy that would complain about that. And, of course, everyone, if he does come off the bench, is going to be like, oh, this is why you got to get rid of Kevin Love. I submit to you that playing specifically defense against the Golden State Warriors is just a bad matchup for Kevin Love. We didn't have these problems in the first couple rounds of playoffs. The vast majority of opponents in this NBA right now, this isn't a problem or an issue, but sometimes you run into certain matchups, and in Kevin Love's case, it's the Warriors, and it's Kevin Love on the defensive end, more than, I think, the offensive end, where sometimes it's just a bad matchup.
I think it's both, though. I think it's both because, again, because of what they've done to him, and this also isn't Kevin Love's fault, and I don't want to sound like a broken record when I say this, but this is a 6'11", spot-up three-point shooter, which is what Steve Kerr used to be. Which is what J.R. Smith kind of is now. Not 6'11", those guys. But they've turned him into something that he's not supposed to be. Can he stroke and stretch defenses from the outside? Yes. Should that be the only place they lock him? No. They need to use him properly. And if he starts coming in off the bench and starts coming in against some of the Warriors' second team, I hope they get him down on the block and let him do the things that he can do down there, then step away and stretch the defense with that sweet stroke that he sometimes has, that is tremendous when it's cooking, that is awful when it's not. They can't just rely on him to be only that. Now, before we take this time out, Steph Curry, are you ready to go? Are you ready to take the Cavaliers apart in game four and atone for your three off games that you have had so far in the NBA Finals as the league's first ever unanimous MVP?
We're locked in and focused. We had a good shoot around, good practice for film session yesterday. I think we're mentally ready for the challenge tonight.
So we're locked in and focused. Good shoot around, good film session. We are mentally ready for the challenge tonight. Really? That's Steph Curry's explanation or his observation or his feelings on things thus far. But that's not the feeling that everybody has when it comes to the Golden State Warriors. Brian Windhorst, among others, who, of course, has been covering the NBA for a long, long time for ESPN, covering LeBron James since high school, Brian Windhorst got a peek at practice, and he said Steph Curry was flat-out awful in practice. He's not making shots, and doesn't look like he's ready for game four.
Disclaimer.
The hands are out. Brian's special hands are out.
Predictions. I'm just telling you what I saw.
Okay.
I watched him shoot for about 25 minutes yesterday, and he looked terrible.
What, shooting the ball?
Terrible.
Good. His movements are just not making shots.
Just, everything looked bad.
That's a good thing. That is a good thing.
Okay, now, I mean, I've seen this man make 25 threes in a row in practice. I've seen him where he gets so bored making regular threes that he starts shooting the ball 20 feet in the air to try to make 20-foot high threes.
Oh, yeah.
He was so frustrated at one point, he went over and sort of stretched out a little bit. He was off.
What was he stretching?
He was stretching his leg and his knee.
There we go. Why do you guys say it's good if he's missing shots in practice?
Because we want the Cavaliers to win. That's why, you moron. That's from ESPN earlier today. So Brian Windhorst saying this guy has not looked good in practice any more than he has in games. That could indeed be a good thing for the Cavaliers. All right, going to take this time out now, top of the hour, Sports Center. Going to come back, going to talk about the life and the legend of Muhammad Ali a little bit as well, as he is laid to rest. Literally the memorial service going on at this hour. That'll be part of hour number two of the extravaganza coming right.
Myself and Coach Lou, we talk a lot about game plan. At the end of the day, he has the last say-so. And then it's for me to go relay it to the rest of the group and get those guys to buy in on what needs to be done to help us win. I don't think anyone actually knew the number or how many consecutive times they had beat us. We just knew they had beat us in game one and game two, and they beat us pretty well. We wanted to just come out with a better effort, sustain a better effort, close to 48 minutes as possible, and live with the results. Well, in the last 2 years, we've had some extreme situations happen to us, and so guys have been able to just, you know, next man up. That's always been our motto. You know, for someone that's out and can't perform or can't play at that point in time, then it's next man up. And
it's all about our efforts, especially the starting five, how we start the game, because you assume they're going to play with the same energy as they did in game three. For us, we have to just stop that force that they play with in game three and come with more effort and more focus from the jump.
Representing all of hockey with great distinction for five decades, number nine.
Now coming up on the right side. Now over the line to his father, son to father. Back in time.
Tell you what, Danny, so do I. It's just a pleasure to see this big guy out there. Big Father Time still doing his thing out here, and they're going to give him a standing ovation here in the Montreal Forum.
He was the one guy without a weakness. He had wonderful shots, front hand, back hand. He was ambidextrous, so could shoot from both sides. He was big. He was tough. He was a wonderful skater. He had maximum anticipation. Gordy, in his whole career, never wasted a step. He could figure out where the puck was going, and he'd go there in the shortest distance.
He could kill penalty, pay the power play, regular shift. He used to carry the puck smooth. You know, very dangerous. He could shoot the puck. Strong player.
He could do everything on the ice, and he was so big and strong that you feared him when he was out there. And he could put the puck in the net. He could make the plays. He was the all-round ultimate hockey player.
This is the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Hour number two is underway right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. We are Toledo Sports Leader. Thanks for joining us. 866-240-1065. Remember that number. We want you to dial up and be a part of our free-for-all Friday. Anything you want to talk about is fair game, whether you want to get into game number four of the NBA Finals, as we just discussed with Jim Cushlin. Chris Lemieux is here as well with us. Chris is a frequent guest of this program, also a part-time producer on this program, so he is here as well. We'll get his thoughts, and we certainly want you to be a part of the show, too. So dial us up or hit us up on Twitter or on Facebook, whatever your preference might be. Facebook, it's 106.5. The Ticket. Twitter is Sports Radio 106.5. The death of Gordie Howe, obviously moving a lot of hockey fans, certainly a lot of Red Wings fans, one of the true legends, and I'm going to be careful I say this, of sport, okay? Not just of hockey, even though he was known, of course, as Mr. Hockey. Gordie Howe transcended his sport because he was one of the best of all time at his sport. When you think of the names of the greatest players ever in team sports, you think of the names of Jim Brown, Jerry Rice, Joe Montana. You think of the names of Babe Ruth, Hank Aaron, Willie Mays, just to throw some at you. You think of the names of Bill Russell, Magic Johnson, Larry Bird, Wilt Chamberlain, the greatest players of all time, and, of course, Michael Jordan. So when you advance that, you think of Wayne Gretzky. You think of Gordie Howe. You probably think of Bobby Orr. You probably think of Mario Lemieux. And there's probably others. But we're talking about one of the greatest ever at his sport. And that makes him one of the greatest ever in the world of sports. So we know that there are a lot of hockey fans who are, of course, going to be trying to remember, and older fans, because, you know, Gordie Howe died at the age of 88. Older fans who remembered him from his heyday are going to be trying to explain to their grandkids today what Gordie Howe was like as a hockey player. That's a huge, huge honor when you are going to try to share with another generation how great someone was. So I bring that up today for the obvious of reasons to pay respects to and say RIP, rest in peace to Gordie Howe. Certainly condolences to his family and friends and anybody who was a huge fan of hockey, particularly Red Wings hockey, because of the passing of the legend. Now, the passing of a legend, of course, is what else is being monitored today. And the death of Muhammad Ali this past weekend, culminating now in a memorial service that is ongoing. We're going to try to carry some of that for you. We're unable to do so at this particular point in time. We'll see if that changes. But fans and fighters and opponents and trainers and more have been trying to put into words what Muhammad Ali's career really meant to them for the last six, 7 days now. I guess six. Anyway. But they've been trying to explain what it's like, you know, to lose the greatest. And that's what I just called Gordie Howe, one of the greatest of all time in his sport and therefore in sports. Well, Muhammad Ali just was summarized as the greatest fighter of all time, the greatest boxer of all time, the greatest competitor of all time, the greatest showman of all time. You can pick your noun to follow the greatest. You could just turn the greatest from a modifier into that noun and end it right there. Just the greatest. And everybody has something to say about it. I just wanted to offer a few more words on this day of his memorial service and his passing. But first I want to let one of my favorite all-time fighters speak a little bit, who was on SportsCenter this morning about it. Sugar Ray Leonard became Sugar Ray Leonard, I think, in large part because there was a Muhammad Ali. Okay? He just was. Ali, to the heavyweight division, was what Leonard tried to be for the welterweight division and then middleweights. He brought a show to the ring, more than just tremendous skills with tremendous hand speed and tremendous heart. He brought a show and a flair and a smile to the ring that just transcended his toughness. You know, Ali looked so pretty, and he made sure everybody knew it, too. You know, talking about how pretty he was. And he was. He was. Muhammad Ali might have been one of the best-looking athletes, if I can say that, with a full, track record of heterosexuality. I'm telling you, Muhammad Ali is one handsome man. When he was younger, he just was. And you look at that smile, and you look at that appearance, and you think, this guy can't be tough. And then you saw him fight with the heart and the will that he had. And my gosh, that's one of the things that made him so great. Same thing with Sugar Ray Leonard. Sugar Ray Leonard came along, burst on the scene in the 1976 Olympics, I think, as a gold medalist. Those looks, that smile, that personality, that charisma, and just a look that said he's pretty, so he can't be tough. And then it just completely belied that toughness. His looks just, you know, maybe it lulled people into a sense of false security, like they're going to go in and knock this pretty boy out. And Sugar Ray, like Muhammad, was just a killer. And he copied so many of his moves, too. The Ali Shuffle that he perfected and really kind of brought to the mainstream. Sugar Ray Leonard used, the bolo punches, just the showmanship in the ring. Anyway, that's a long setup just because I love Sugar Ray Leonard so much. It's a long setup to just a few seconds of what Sugar Ray had to say about the passing of Muhammad Ali on SportsCenter a little bit earlier this morning.
What is this day?
And I'm having a problem here with my audio. Hold on 1 second. Let's see if we can make this work.
I'm here to honor him. I never thought that Muhammad will be gone, but he's gone to a better place. And I have so many fond memories with Muhammad. He taught me without being there. He gave me inspiration. He gave me hope. He was the one who allowed me to become Sugar Ray Leonard, because he opened up all the doors and all the windows that at one time were blockage of me being as successful as I've been. I love the man. I respected the man. To me, he was family. He was my brother.
He was more than his brother. As I said, he was kind of his predecessor. He kind of set the table for guys like Sugar Ray Leonard to kind of follow in his legacy as a showman and as a man who could bring the crowd with him. Half the crowd was going to love him. Half the crowd was going to want somebody to wipe that smile off his face and to dirty up and mess up that pretty face the same way they did with Muhammad. Same way so many people wanted Sonny Liston just to beat this pretty boy's mouth shut back when he won the first one, the title from Sonny Liston. So everybody, George Foreman, all of Ali's former opponents, again, trainers and more, having something to say. We'll try to give a few more of those to you before we're done. But as promised, as it is a free-for-all Friday, I want to go back to the phones. Any of these topics you want to get into, let's get into them together at 866-240-1065. I want to go to Toledo and say good afternoon to Josh on the Extravaganza. Josh, thanks for joining us. What's on your mind, good sir?
Well, sir, I love the show, I have to say. I was listening to Dan Levitard's show earlier, and he threw out a stat line as when LeBron James was just stinking it up in the 2013 finals. He threw out the stat lines, and we crucified him for his playing abilities, or lack thereof. And every stat line he had from those finals are better than Curry's current stat lines, but yet we make excuses for him. I just wanted your thoughts on that.
Well, two things I would say. I heard the same thing. It's funny, we were listening to Levitard at the same time today. I heard the line too, and I'm gonna try to remember it because I was in the car, didn't write it down, but it was something to the effect of Curry is averaging, 16 and shooting 43%, and he's averaging like 4 assists and 4 rebounds or something through these 3 games. And LeBron in the 2011 finals, in which they got beaten by the Mavericks, LeBron averaged 17 points. He shot 46 or 7% and had 7 assists a game, I think. So all of those, as you just pointed out, were higher than Curry's. And as Levitard pointed out, LeBron got crucified, got killed for stinking it up in the finals in such a way. And two things I would say, and it said people are making excuses for Curry. I disagree with the last part. I don't know. Have you heard anybody like making excuses for Curry? Because most of what I've heard and what I've said on this show is that I don't understand it. Are the Cavs defending him just that well, or is he tightening up and choking because he has been a non-factor? I don't know many other ways to say dude isn't getting it done. Dude was averaging 31 points a game in the regular season and about half that in the finals. I'm not making excuses for the guy. Have you heard anybody doing that?
I just hear just people saying, oh, well, maybe he's still hurt or this. No. Chalk it up to the Cavs. They're defending him awfully well. They're getting in his head. I just don't see why we're going easy on him as opposed to LeBron James. We practically hung him.
Well, then now here's part two, since you brought that part up. Here's part two. First of all, I don't see anybody taking it easy on Curry. People are just mesmerized as to why he's not playing so well. But here's the big difference. Part two for me is, where was LeBron in 2011? He was in his first season with the Miami Heat. What was LeBron in 2011? He was the guy that everybody in America started hating because just a few months before that, he did the televised decision. And he left his city and his team hanging out to dry to go down there and create this super team with Dwayne Wade and Chris Bosh so they could. So, and then what did they do right before the start of that season? If you remember, Josh, they had that stupid celebration down there in the smoke-filled Miami Arena, whatever it's called, American Airlines or whatever. And, you know, and he sat on that stage, if you recall, on that bar stool and said, I'm here to win not one, not two, not three, not four. And he did that all the way up to not 7 NBA championships. So he did a pretty good job, I think, at that time of casting himself as the villain, the guy that everybody was just like, are you kidding me? You talk about narcissism, you know, the decision on TV, then that production, and now here you go with your super team, and you're getting smoked by Dirk Nowitzki and the Dallas Mavericks, and your 30 points a game is only 17, and you're choking it up in the finals. So I think the criticism he got was as much for who he was and how he had been acting at that time, given the circumstances of his career going down there. I think that's why people were just ready to crucify him for that bad performance, whereas Curry is coming off of what? a championship already. He just won one last year, and he won the back-to-back MVPs. And so folks are like, wow, dude is stinking it up in these finals. But they're not going to be as brutal to him as they were to LeBron because of what LeBron was coming into and where Curry is, what Curry is coming off of.
Well, I appreciate taking my call, and as always, you had a very solid rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, my friend. I'm glad to have the call, Josh. Thank you. And by the way, to anybody, look, you know, you call me and ask me a question, always all I'm going to give you is my opinion. It doesn't make it right, but I appreciate that you respected that rebuttal enough because that's I really think the circle. When I heard Le Batard talking about that today, and he said, we just killed LeBron, he started blaming Bayless, Skip Bayless. When Le Batard and Stu Gatz and the guys were talking, they were talking about Bayless. Now, Bayless, you know, unfairly tore LeBron James apart and set this standard so high that, you know, this is when somebody stinks it up, you better be killing everybody like that the way you killed LeBron. And they said it was unfair how he killed LeBron. And I don't think it was. I really don't. Like I said, now I will also admit this. Little bias here. Full disclosure. I was doing sports radio in Cleveland in 2011, not in Toledo. I was covering the Cavaliers on a daily basis, and I had an up-close and front front seat for the decision. Not that I mean I was in the room, but I mean the reaction of those Cavaliers fans to the decision, man, I was in the middle of, and I got to tell you, I flat-out hated him for that. And it wasn't just because of the decision and the narcissism that went into him doing that and then leaving. It was because of what precipitated it. You know, the phony elbow injury in the playoffs. Oh, my elbow hurts. I can't shoot right. I might not be able to carry this team because my elbow hurts. You remember the story in that last season before he left. And he was examined by multiple doctors and experts around the country who all of them looked at it and said, there ain't nothing wrong with his elbow. And it looked manufactured and fake, like he was kind of jaking it, like he didn't want to win a championship in Cleveland because that would have completely blown his plans to leave Cleveland for Miami with his buddies out of the water. And he and the son of Mickey Arison in Miami had orchestrated this the year before when they were together, or actually in 06 when they were at the Olympics is when they first, or the World Championships when they first started talking about it. And when he became a free agent and Bosch became a free agent, they were all going to get together and play together with D-Wade. They put that plan together, and a lot of evidence points to him not wanting to win a championship in Cleveland, because if he did, what champion wins one and leaves? Nobody does that. Bird didn't win one in Boston and then go sign as a free agent somewhere else. A champion does what? A champion defends his title. He couldn't have left then. So the fake injury, the incredibly horrific playoff performances, 13 turnovers in a game, and you know, 6 for 15 from the floor, no, 4 for 15 from the floor, and not trying to, all that stuff led to a whole lot of real hatred for LeBron James in the city of Cleveland. And that, I think, transferred to the rest of the country. Everybody became a Mavericks fan because they wanted to see this braggadocious Miami group with their not one, not two, not three show before they had ever even played a game together. They wanted to see that team be chopped down to size. And when the guy at the center of it all, LeBron, was chopped down to size to the point where he had a horrible finals, they did crucify him, and I think with just cause. Now, Steph is having a horrible finals, too. But they're not losing 2-1. They're not on pace to lose the series like LeBron did back in 2011. They're on pace to win it. Now, if they lose tonight and he has another clunker, talking about Steph Curry, and he's still not there, and the shot isn't there, the effort isn't there, the nonchalance and the look, the disinterested look are still there, you're going to start to see a lot more sharp knives coming for Steph Curry's reputation. You're going to see a lot more people coming after him and saying, what the heck is going on? While they're winning and he's playing poorly is one thing. But if they lose twice in a row and end up with an even series at 2-2 going back to Golden State, watch and see how quickly the critics come out and say, enough is enough. We got to call this guy out and we got to figure out what it is now. So that, I think, is the big difference. If you disagree, by all means, hit us up at 866-240-1065. Mark in Toledo wants to talk about the legend, not the late Muhammad Ali being laid to rest today, but the late Gordie Howe, who passed away earlier today. Hey, Mark, how are you?
Real good. Was on my way home, heard the topic, heard the sad news that Gordie passed today, and I had the great fortune of meeting him several times. And what a gentleman he was. But the odd thing is, on the way home, I'm thinking of the Ali funeral, and I'm sitting at home now watching an Ali funeral, and two of the greats are gone now from sports. And just when I think about it, as a young boy delivering papers and seeing the Frazier Ali fight, and then getting a chance to meet the great Gordie Howe, what a great loss for sports in our society. What both these gentlemen brought to the world and showed the class of what sports is about and how it can be done should be a great example, not only for grown men like myself, but for young men and young people that want to learn how to do things right. Folks, right there it is.
What were the circumstances that you were able to meet Gordie on numerous occasions? Because that's got to be just an incredible thrill. One of the greatest athletes, and I'll say that like I did earlier, one of the greatest athletes, not just in his sport, but in all sports of all time. How did you come to hang with Gordie?
I coached hockey for 25 years, and Gordie, his family lives here in Sylvania. Murray's a great great professional and great doctor here in town.
Sure.
And I had the good pleasure of meeting Murray as well. But for his 65th birthday, he came to Tam O'Shanter. And at that time, my son, which is now 30, had the chance to meet Gordie when he was 5. So I was 88, so it would have been 23 years ago, I guess. But he's about 7. So he got the chance to meet Gordie in a private room because of my connections and knowing some people here in town, got to meet Gordie that way.
Gotcha.
But numerous times where we ran into him in Traverse City or when we were at the Joe and he'd be signing different things, his memory, even though it was much worse at the end, he could still remember people that he had that contact with. And I walked through the Joe one time and he was signing books and he goes, "Hey," he couldn't remember my name.
But he knew you. He knew he had spent some time talking.
And he wanted to start talking again. And he'd talk, and everybody's like, "How do you know him?" And so, it was just a coincidence and a couple of strange meetings. And my daughter made a Facebook post as well. She goes, "I'm really happy that I got the chance to meet Gordie. I've got a pair of skates in the basement that she will not let me get rid of because Gordie Howe touched them."
So. And you know what? Good for her. That is awesome. I was saying this earlier on, if you don't have a long-time relationship with the game or the Wings or with Gordie, it's going to be, because you're younger, it's going to be up to grandpas or fathers, depending on how old you might be, but you got to pass this down and really let people know what a loss this is. Most people know what a loss Muhammad Ali is because he transcended all sports. I mean, truly, there was a point in time where his face was the most recognizable face on planet Earth, maybe more so than the Pope, more so than the U.S. president at any given time. He was so famous that it's just hard to quantify, and his legend has been passed down. But for casual hockey fans or non-hockey fans or just younger hockey fans who've heard the name, they may remember a little bit about Gretzky, but they have no memory at all of Gordie Howe. It's good to have people like you who knew him and who knew of him and could tell stories not just about the way he played, but the way he treated people, the way you just did, to make sure that the younger generation pays their proper respects to the passing of a legend.
Yeah, I agree 100%. And one of the really funny stories to that, though, as well is, to talk about how great Gordie was, but then nobody really knew who he was. We were at the ice rink one day, and the guys come in the locker room, they're like, "Hey, who's the old man standing outside our locker room?" And my son goes, "Well, that's Gordie Howe." They're like, "Oh, BS. That's not Gordie." And my son went out, grabbed him, pulled him in. He goes, "Hey, how's it going, Susie?" And that's what he called all the kids.
Yeah.
And gave him an elbow, and they're like, they don't believe who you are. Well, all of a sudden there's 20 boys running out of the locker room to get pins so they can get Gordie Howe's autograph. But yeah, he was like that. He would take all day long to take care of the fans. And even with his declining health in the last couple of years, he'd still even stop out at Tam O'Shanter and sign autographs and say hello to everybody. But, sad, sad day losing both Gordy and
taking. If I may ask you this, taking, yeah. You know, the loyalty to the Wings out, the fact that he won four cups with the Wings and what, six Hart trophies and all of that. Wayne Gretzky or Gordie Howe? Because that's the only other name mentioned when people talk about the greatest hockey player ever. Almost everyone says Wayne Gretzky, the greatest ever because of all of the records. He broke all of Gordy's records. Gordy was always so incredibly humble and so very hospitable in being there as often as he could in the arena when Gretzky would break one of them and would shake his hand and the whole thing. And it's such a mutual respect there between the two. But just as a 25-year hockey coach, if you can take yourself away from the loyalty part, who is better?
Across the board, I'd still have to say, and I kind of decline to what Gretzky says, Gordy's Mr. Hockey.
Yeah, that's right.
Gordy
that's exactly
could do it all. Right. He could score. He could fight. He could make things happen on the ice. Not that Wayne Gretzky could not fight. He was protected in the way the game was played then. But Gordy didn't have that protector. He protected himself and his teammates and still was the scorer, the assist maker, the defender of it all. So I would still have to say it was Gordie Howe.
There's a picture that would indicate that. I mean, if you've ever seen the build of Wayne Gretzky, I mean, you know, he was not a big, strong, tough guy who could be a protector like you're talking about. He just wasn't built that way. He's very slender of frame, obviously. His greatness was in his, he wasn't even the fastest either. It was his instincts, which were better than everyone else's, his quickness, his incredible accuracy, all of those things. But I just tweeted about, I don't know, 10 minutes ago before your call came in, a picture of Gordie Howe shirtless in the 50s, and I don't know if this is in the locker room, while changing after a game or what it was, but there is a picture of Gordie Howe looking more buff than anybody should have been allowed to be in the 1960s. I mean, I'm not kidding you. He looks like he could play linebacker in that picture. He looks like he could play linebacker in the NFL today. And that's before any of the training, you know, the extra training supplements, the legal stuff I'm talking about, or the illegal stuff. He just ripped. And anybody who's on Twitter right now, go to Sports Radio 106.5, and you'll see that picture of Gordy. And it just kind of underscores what you said about how he could not only protect himself, but even his teammates. He wasn't, you know, the slender guy that needed an enforcer out there to run interference for him. Gordy could do all of it himself, and that is amazing.
Correct.
All right. Hey, thank you, my friend. That's a great reminiscing.
Thank you. Take care, and pleasure, and sad, sad day.
Indeed it is, and thank you for helping us remember everything that you just did about Gordie Howe. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You got it. Great phone call. Really, really appreciate that. We're going to get a timeout here, but just to answer my own question, the one that I just asked of him about Gordie versus Wayne, Wayne's Gretzky on Twitter said today what Wayne Gretzky has said many times since his own retirement. And even when he was breaking Gordy's records, what did Gretzky always say? The same thing he said in his tweet today. 4 hours ago today, this was Wayne Gretzky's official statement on Twitter. Quote, "Unfortunately, we lost the greatest hockey player ever today, but more importantly, the nicest man I have ever met. Sending our thoughts and prayers to the Howe family and to the millions of hockey fans who, like me, loved Gordie Howe. R.I.P. Mr. Hockey." So now, even again in his passing, Wayne Gretzky wants everybody to know that Gordie Howe, not himself, whose nickname was the Great One, Gordie Howe was the greatest player of all time. Whether that's accurate or not is a matter of opinion, but the fact that Wayne thinks it's accurate speaks volumes. Tremendous, tremendous tribute there. Thank you for that little stroll down memory lane and your personal interactions with Gordie Howe and his family. Get a timeout now. Bottom of the hour Sports Center coming up. More phone calls. We got time for them. We'll take you until 5 o'clock in drive time with Mike Miller, who's going to talk more, I have no doubt, about the passing of Gordie Howe when he comes your way at 5 o'clock right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Once again, it's the Bob France Extravaganza, ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
It is indeed the Extravaganza, final segment of the broadcast this afternoon on a Friday. Thanks for being a part of it. Really, really good calls today on the NBA Finals. Steph Curry, Muhammad Ali, Gordie Howe. Really, really a tremendous look back at Gordie Howe, not just the player, but the person, from somebody who knew him up close a bit through family and other things locally. Chris Lemieux is with us as well. Chris is running our show for us. He's been a guest for us today, or for us throughout the last several months as well. Chris, you had some thoughts on Gordie Howe too. What did you want? What did you want to offer?
Yeah, like I was just listening to that guy talking about, like, you know, what Gordie Howe was, and like comparing with Gretzky and everything.
Yeah.
I for me, the thing that stands out for me with, when it comes to Gordie Howe, is just looking how long he played. You realize his last hockey game he played was with the IHL in 1997. He
played in 6 decades.
6 decades, and like even without counting out the IHL, like we're talking about like, you know, Hartford Whalers, like he was playing for it in his, to the point where like his sons were in hockey and he was playing with his sons. Like this guy played forever. Like he just keep going.
Yeah, you're exactly right. And that's one of the things, you know, he is what I think the best definition would be, a true hockey lifer. You know what I mean?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Somebody who dedicated himself to the sport, not just the league, not just his team or his franchise or certain fans. He was in love with the game. He was a hockey lifer, and he would play no matter when he could, where he could, for as long as he could. And whether it was a stunt for some people or not, you know, to get him out there on the ice in his 60s, he took it seriously. And that's the best tribute I think that you can give to a great player, somebody who is an all-time great, is that they were totally in love with their sport, not with their own self, not in love with their reputation, not in love with fan adulation or endorsements. He was in love with the sport that he devoted his life to, and you could tell that every step of the way.
And talking about his records too, like it's not like the years between him and Gretzky were completely barren. Like we were talking about, you know, Bobby Orr was in the sport, and like and some of the other just greats in the 60s and 70s, and no one touched anything Gordie did. Like I mean, my favorite number is number 9. A lot of that's because of Gordie Howe. You know, I grew up a Detroit fan and everything, and just everything about what he did was just, you keep looking back and you keep hearing stories, and not even like that far gone. Like I remember, I think a couple years ago it was, the Detroit Red Wings were in the playoffs and Gordie Howe was in the locker room shaking hands. He like interrupted a press conference with Jimmy Howard, their goaltender, to like shake his hand and just start walking away. And I remember watching the camera. These kids were like running around the locker room and almost ran into him. And he just, like, out of old hockey player habits, he raises up his elbow to give them a shiver or something. And they don't hit it, but it just to see those, even, you know, in his kind of waning days, just see those reflexes in him. It's like you just look at him and you just thought, how did this guy ever stop playing hockey?
Yeah, it's so amazing. And there's going to be obviously a lot more of what we're doing right now, what you're doing right now, Chris Lemieux, in the coming days, next Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and on. Much like there was this week for Muhammad Ali, a little bit of a different circumstance, of course, because Ali was not only famous for his fighting, he was also infamous for some controversial things out of the ring. Gordie Howe's career, his life, his entire legacy is going to be surrounding hockey over the course of the next several days and weeks and months for many, looking back at the life of the great Gordie Howe. I want to shift, though, in the final segment of the show to talk a little bit more about Muhammad Ali, because this will largely be the end of all of these commemorations and memorials, at least until the one-year anniversary of the death of Muhammad, you know, next year. But laying him to rest today with a big star-studded funeral cast of people delivering eulogies and you know, like I said, just kind of commemorating the career. I wanted to say a few more words about him and about his career and what he meant to me as a fight fan. I said some of this on Monday's show because this happened last weekend, obviously, and if you heard it then, I apologize if it sounds redundant to you, but I don't have too many other words to say than the ones that I chose about Muhammad Ali. And FYI, I know he did not go to Vietnam. I know he was stripped of his title and was sentenced to prison for not going into the military draft the way he was supposed to. I know there was a lot of controversy about his womanizing, cheating on wives, etc. All of that documented in the movie Ali with Will Smith and in many other places. I know about the controversial participation in the Nation of Islam. I know about his stance on civil rights and all of the above. I am choosing not to focus on those things because we are a sports show. Those are conversations in my mind for a different forum. And they are certainly not the conversations that I want to have as we say goodbye to a man that I feel is probably the greatest fighter in the history of the ring. Even if he might not have been the best fighter in the history of the ring. And this is what I mean. Muhammad Ali, the boxer, was to me the emblem, the very personification of courage. The very personification of sacrifice at the altar of greatness. And I'll explain what I mean by that. Muhammad Ali came up at a time when the heavyweight division of professional boxing was loaded with some of the all-time greats, was loaded at the time he came up after winning the gold medal at the Olympics with some of the all-time greats, and that would be filled for the next 10, 11, 12, 13, 15 years of his career with some of the greatest heavyweights to ever fight. And Muhammad Ali did not come up into that division, whether it was Sonny Liston the first time when he won the title, or whether it was through Frazier three times, or Norton, or whether it was through George Foreman. Muhammad Ali did not come up into that era timidly, saying, I've got to find my place. I got to work my way into this. This is going to be tough. He came into this thing attacking the biggest, baddest men in arguably in the history of the sport, attacking them with his mouth. Attacking them with his fists, attacking him with his mind, attacking him with his heart. That's what he did. When he won the gold medal in 1960, with tremendous hand speed and foot speed, he looked like he was a welterweight, not a heavyweight. He won the light heavyweight title in 1960 in Rome. And then when he came in, he was never going to be able to hang. Fighting that way against the biggest, hardest punching fighters in the world, including champion Sonny Liston. Sonny Liston became the world heavyweight champion 2 years after Ali won that gold medal when he knocked out Floyd Patterson in 1962. Floyd Patterson was a good fighter. He was a tremendous fighter, and he was dominated by Sonny Liston. Sonny Liston knocked him out at 206 of the first round. Then in the rematch with Patterson, he lasted 4 seconds longer. He was knocked out at 210. Sonny Liston was a freaking human bear. I mean, that kind of grizzly-like strength. He was mean. He was nasty. He didn't want to talk. All he wanted to do was knock your head off of your shoulders. Split your skull open until it leaked. That's what he wanted to do. Muhammad Ali, then Cassius Clay, came up to that and said, I want the title. He came in and said, I want Sonny Liston. And he didn't just say, I want to have a chance with him. He said, I'm going to knock the heavyweight champion of the world out. And I'm going to do it with style and flash and charisma. And you know what? People said, Sonny, shut that boy up. People said, you got to wipe the smile off of this big mouth's face. Nobody believed Cassius Clay could beat Sonny Liston. He was a 7-1 betting underdog. 7-1. And he comes up and starts doing poems, talking about Sonny Liston going out and eight, called him a big ugly bear like I just referred to him. It was accurate. He knocked out Sonny Liston. And then proceeded to become the first of what the WWE would eventually come to call, or professional wrestling would come to call, heels. He would become the first heel. He didn't care if it made people hate him. He was willing to be the heel because it made people want to watch him, even if it was making them want to watch him lose and watch him get the taste smacked out of his mouth. His courage to play that role, to tick off and anger his opponents, knowing he was going to take some shots, but knowing that he had supreme confidence in his hands, in his feet, in his evasiveness, his defense, everything about Muhammad Ali. The poems weren't just poems. He believed them. Flow like a butterfly, sting like a bee. Your hands can't hit what your eyes can't see. He meant it. And there was something about that kind of an athlete that transcended his time that no one has ever been able to duplicate. Even if, as I was giving praise to Sugar Ray Leonard for trying to do that at lighter weight classes earlier, and he did, nobody did it like Ali. The courage of Muhammad Ali to do what he did, and then to face Liston again in the rematch, and that's the one a lot of people feel was fixed, feel like it was a phantom punch, that Liston took a dive, he was in deep debt, he owed money to the mob, and he did what he had to do to get that debt paid. I don't care. Ali didn't know it. Ali didn't care about it. Ali wanted to get him again. That's why he stood over him in that iconic photo and said, "Get up!" He wanted more. But to become the champion, and then to have, of course, the interruption. 3.5 years he was not fighting because he was banned from boxing because of the aforementioned Vietnam stuff. I'm not focusing on that. I'm focusing on the fact that when he was allowed to start up again, he came back 3.5 years later, completely rusty, unable to generate the same type of hand speed and the same type of defense and the same type of everything that he had 3.5 years earlier, and challenged the new champion, Joe Frazier, who was dominant, losing that fight. And then having the courage to come back after it and saying, "I want George Foreman," the man who turned around and beat Frazier. Frazier beats Ali in a tremendous war in Ali Frazier 1. Foreman proceeds to dribble Joe Frazier around the ring like a basketball, dropped him 6 times in 3 rounds. And Ali looks at him and says, "I want you." He's like, "Wait a minute, little man, old man. I just did to Joe Frazier what nobody has ever done before, and Joe Frazier just whooped you. You want who? Me?" And George Foreman, being the biggest, baddest, most unbelievably physically menacing heavyweight maybe ever, he was Mike Tyson long before Mike Tyson, but bigger, stronger, and threw a harder punch than Mike Tyson. That's who George Foreman was. And Muhammad Ali said, "Yeah, I want my title back, and I'm taking it from you." And he knew what it was going to do, what it was going to take to get it. He knew he was going to have to subject himself to a physical pounding that nobody could ever even imagine receiving. He knew he was going to put his body through a meat grinder because he was going to get into the ring and allow George Foreman to pound on him for as many rounds as it took for George Foreman to get tired. Knowing that he was not a guy who could go the distance, knowing he was a first, second, or third round knockout king, he was going to take the blows from George Foreman, whose arms looked like normal men's thighs, and absorb that beating just to tire him out long enough to do what he did in the eighth round in 1974. And then to go back at it in 2 more wars with Frazier in 2 and 3, including the thriller. Muhammad Ali's courage in the ring is always going to be what I remember. His courage, his charisma, his will, his heart. That is what made him the greatest. And as they lay him to rest today, I want to end this show by paying my respects to the greatest. Forget about the stuff outside of the ring. In the ring, in the sport, that's the Muhammad Ali I will always cherish and remember as a fight fan. Till the day I die. Thanks for listening to the show today. I really appreciate it. Great stuff coming up. Drive Time. Mike Miller, he'll talk more about Gordie Howe, I am sure. Have yourself a great weekend. We'll see you Monday.
Stop. Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.